Good afternoon, everybody. My name is John Glezel. I'm from the Department of Government here at the LSE. And I'm an affiliate of LSE LSE Research on Southeastern Europe. And I'm delighted to invite you to enjoy the discussion this afternoon, which is the Policy Roundtable on Administrative and Economic Reform in Romania, Lessons for the Region. This is the second in a new series of events that LSE is putting on in honor of the late Professor Ghițu Ionescu. The first event we ran around about 3 weeks ago, and it was a keynote speech by the President of Romania, Traian Băsescu. So this is going to be the second in a series of what we hope to become regular and recurring events over the coming years. The series is named in honor of Professor Ghițu Ionescu, who was initially a Romanian diplomat who served in Turkey, I believe, immediately after the war, and then remained outside of Romania when Romania shifted towards communism. He then served as the head of the Romanian service for Radio Free Europe in Munich, before moving around and finally settling in Britain, where he followed an academic career. Professor Ionescu taught here at the LSE, which is the reason that we're naming this series in his honour, and at the University of Manchester. While he was here, he founded a journal that was known as, and still known as, Government and Opposition. And one of the features of this journal was that it tried to look at the relationship between policy and theory in the political realm. And so that's underwriting that was the motive for this particular panel and the motive for inviting this particularly distinguished set of guests that we have this evening. So let me introduce them to you. The first speaker will be Ms. Monica McElvey. She's currently a member of the European Parliament, a position that she's held since 2009. Between 2004 and 2007, I'm sure many of you know, she served as the Minister of Justice for Romania. And she became particularly well known during that period for her efforts to fight corruption in the period leading up to Romania's accession. She's also, and this is why she's particularly relevant to our discussion, putting Romania in a regional framework tonight, she's also done a lot of work across Southeastern Europe. She worked as the anti-corruption advisor to the Prime Minister of Macedonia. In Bosnia, she served as consultant to the Council of Europe on judicial reform. In Kosovo, she worked for the OSCE mission, and she's worked for the European Commission as a trainer on anti-corruption measures and judicial reform in EU candidate countries. The second of our speakers will be Professor Alan Smith, who is Emeritus Professor of Political Economy at the School of Slavonic and East European Studies at the University College London. Over an extensive career, Professor Smith has taught at Dartmouth College in the United States and the College of Europe in Bruges. In addition to a vast academic publishing record, Alan has actually been writing the reports on Romania for the Economist Intelligence Unit reports since 1984. And so, as I was suggesting to Alan immediately before this talk, for many of us, he's defined our understanding of the Romanian economy. Certainly, any understanding that I have of the Romanian economy has come via Alan that way. And our third speaker will be Dr. Cătălin Avramescu, who is currently, and this is going to be a literal translation, state councillor in the chancellery of the Romanian president. But if I could interpret that, Cătălin, this would be the equivalent of the chief of staff to Romania's president, Traian Băsescu. Cătălin also is a lecturer at the University of Bucharest and the University of Helsinki. He's published widely in English and Romanian, including a very well-received book on the intellectual history of cannibalism, which has come out with Princeton University Press. Most recently, Cătălin has been nominated and approved to be the next Romanian ambassador to Finland. So the way we're going to organise the panel is I'm going to invite each of the three speakers to deliver a 15-minute overview on a topic of particular interest to them, and after that we'll open it up to discussion with the audience and between the panel members. Monica McElvey will be our first speaker.
Thank you. Can I sit down?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Thank you very much, and I'm very happy to share with you my experience. Since I only have 15 minutes, I will first of all, I'd like to say that it was, and I already start with what happened and the lessons learned. In 2005 and 2006 and a few months in 2007, I was the Minister of Justice. I was not member of any political party, and I think this is very important for a country which wants to do reform and which wants to not to have a politician, meaning with roots in the party, in this position. Then I'd like, so I'd also like to say because I when I say this, then people ask them, how did you become a minister of justice if you weren't a politician? Yes, it's quite probably an unusual story. Just getting a telephone and saying, I would ask you to be the minister of justice, and I was President Băsescu, whom I never met before, and I was working in Bosnia at that time for 3 years. And I was shocked, and then anyway she said, come to my office. So I went to his office, and I just stared at him, and he insisted on that. And the argument he made, and I found afterwards very important, he said, a member of any political party, a lawyer from any party, a party lawyer, would not be able to do the judicial reform. And now I can tell you what I saw afterwards, and I see now when I am in a party. All these roots, all these relationships, all these networks in these parties, in this region, functions differently than here. So I gave you something, I gave you a position, or I gave you a contract, or I made something for you, then you owe to me something, and I have to repay it. So that was very important, because I didn't have such relationship with the party or with anyone else. So in such countries, if to do these reforms and to do anti-corruption at the level of the politicians, so political to fight political corruption, my advice is to have someone from the outside of the political system. Because once again, I'd like to underline this, we say we need to fight political corruption, which means we have corrupt politicians. So that's the assumption from where I live. So why do I take someone from this corrupt political class? There could be exceptions, not everyone corrupted, but it's a network of where a lot are corrupt. So that's why it's good to have someone from the outside. Now I'd like to... And I'd like to quote another statement, and then I'd like to give you some concrete examples of judicial reform. When the first, why it was important, this non-party, and not knowing everyone. When the anti-corruption prosecutor started to investigate high politicians, the first one was a vice president in the government and one member of the alliance in which I was a party. So he was a colleague in the government. And he was very unhappy, he was shouting at me and so on. And I saw on the faces of everyone that they were shocked that I'm in government and I'm investigating. And I remember what the Prime Minister said. I thought we go after the opposition. I think that's typical. And I'm not only referring to Romania, to all these regions, yes? We are in power, we go after the opposition, not. So. Now, going back to the judicial reforms, I think the way it was done in many countries in Romania, and it is being done in other countries in the region, is wrong, and also from my experience. So what happened immediately after 90, we gave judges and prosecutors full independence and all the guarantees. They are appointed for life, it's in the constitution. They cannot be removed or sanctioned or fired by anyone from executive or parliament. Only we set up judicial councils formed of judges and prosecutors as a majority, and they are the only ones who can discipline, who can fire, who can sanction, who can look at what a judge or a prosecutor does. I was on the side of the NGO saying that, okay, if we give full independence, we make them appointed for life, higher salaries in the system, then each of them will behave like the God delivering justice. And that was wrong. That's not true. It's not true. So basically what happens in Romania now, the same in Bulgaria, the same in Macedonia, the same in Croatia, the same in Serbia, is that they are they have all these guarantees, as I said, of independence for life, and they also have judicial councils for mostly of themselves, their peers, they go and elect them. So they are self-governing. Which, if we look today, what happens is that they, this self-government, which is called judicial council, in Romania it's called Superior Council of Magistrates, it has different names in the region. It's a cooperative which protects all the wrongs in the system. Basically, they oppose all the reforms, they don't sanction their peers. They promote, for instance, when they promote their colleagues to the Supreme Court, I heard a lot of amounts, how much it cost, and so on. And no one can ask them anything. They are there for 6 years. They cannot be removed. You can only say something in public, that they do something wrong, but that's all. And anyway, if you say something, then you affect their independence. So it was a fail. These judicial councils are a fail. I would not recommend them. Or if you have them, have in these councils people from the outside, like the courts of jurors from in United States or in other places. So people from outside the system could be, I don't know, private lawyers, but citizens, in a way in which citizens should be involved. I understand that in these countries you don't want to give the power of the judiciary to the government or to the legislator, to the politicians, because we have an experience that of bad behavior. So to whom? Then to the people. That's what I'm saying, to bring people in these councils. Actually, I think in the United States, in many states, the disciplinary committees for judges are only formed of people from the outside of the system. And another lesson learned, although it's quite late for the other countries in the region, is that first you need to do a testing. Before you say, I appoint you for life, you have all these guarantees, you run yourself, you have to know who are these people, who is A, B, C, D, which we didn't do. We just gave to everyone all these powers, and then we expected them to behave nicely. No one was tested professionally or integrity. And another example of how they the wrong way they understood the independence is that I said in 2005, and we still discuss about this, it's 2011, that we need to unify the jurisprudence, which means to have like kind of judicial precedence, because now as you go as to a lottery in the court. Different courts on the same or similar issues will rule opposite decisions, even in the same case, this makes people not to trust the judicial system. You can't trust a system where you get opposite decisions in the same case or in similar cases. And also that's also very bad for investment, for investors. They need predictability, and you can't have predictability with such with a court which applies very differently the same provision of the law. That's also because I mentioned the business sector. It's important, you know, when I come and I draft a contract, I need to know that if a clause of the contract is violated, which is the practice in the court, what will happen? So what is 80% predictable to happen? So that's not possible. Now, the argument of judges to have a unification of practice is that this would affect their independence. So what they say is, I'm a judge, I'm independent, whatever, however I interpret the law, no one can ask me to look how my other colleague, far from how other judge would interpret the same provision of the law. Which you can imagine that it's a chaos, and it's the enforcement of law is very different and not unitary and not predictability. And there is no trust, but that's the way they understood independence. So, in terms of corruption in the judiciary, we have, and I'd like to say that we have cases with 200 or 300 or 400 euros, which is a very small amount, and judges or some media were saying that small amounts means small corruption. I think it's the other way around. For a judge, small amount means systemic corruption. It's much more, it's more dangerous, because I don't think you take 200 euros once in a lifetime. I think you take any time someone offers you 200, 300, 400, which means that the decisions are affected, you know, in a very large proportion rate. We had, like, I think the biggest one or a big one was 10,000. But we also have networks, examples of networks with politicians, with judges from the Supreme Court and businessmen here. Of course, we had some higher amounts of promises. But as a whole, I see it as a systemic problem, which, again, this judicial council formed of themselves, of judges and prosecutors, will not solve it. Some of them are in the system. And it was claimed that it was in the media in 2005 and 7, 6 and 7 in Bulgaria, that also in the judicial council, there are the heads of the mafia in the judicial system. So another point, Lesnar, you need people from the outside, agents of change, who would not expect, and it's not good, it's not, one should not expect that the system will change by itself alone. That would say we want to change ourselves, we want to change the rule, it's not true. People don't want to change, the system will not change. They need to be forced to be changed from the outside. Just one example, as we are in UK, this judicial council, for instance, is responsible also for judicial management. Nothing changed. We ask our colleagues, I ask my colleagues in UK to come and evaluate the Romanian system and to give advice and make proposals of the UK court administration. It's a very good court administration system. There are no presidents of courts here. There are qualified people to do these administrative issues in Romania, and in other countries have presidents. And they can, on their expenses, they spent 4 or 5 months in Romania, the UK Court Administration Service. They went at the courts in the country, and they made proposals. And then the proposal went to the Judicial Council, which voted against. And something else, it's a vote, it's a secret vote. It's a collective and secret vote, so you don't know how they vote. Now, by these proposals to change the constitution, one proposal is to have public vote and to have their decisions motivated. Because if it's a secret vote, they say, we can't motivate the decisions because we don't know who thought what and for which argument voted in a way or another. So no accountability. And anti-corruption, general on anti-corruption, it's important measures, it's important this declaration of assets and interests to be public. We made them public in February 2005. I think in 2006 that wouldn't be possible. There was no political will for that. The political will was decreasing while we are once we are closer to the accession. Actually, we looked at the House of Commons members, the public declaration of assets, when we drafted those in Romania, and we took everything from that. Plus, we added some other things, so they are really very detailed. And that's, I tell you, that's a problem in Europe. In Germany or in France, they are confidential, for instance, for members of the parliament or dignitaries. And you see this different culture in different when it's about on topics, access to information or so on. Conflict of interest to make a crime, and the last mention I'll do is setting up this anti-corruption prosecutor office, DNA, which I think 90% of the Romanian politicians or high civil servants hate it and would dismantle it. And I think if we wouldn't have this for those who know cooperation and verification mechanism after the accession, these anti-corruption prosecutors would not have existed any longer. And they would have, I don't know, emigrated somewhere. save their life. They really investigate people from all parties. As they see, they investigate now people, a lot of people from the party which is in power, and I'm also a member PDL. And I mean that's the highest, you know, the most relevant sign that they are independent when they investigate people in power. And the problem we have is, so we made the first step with investigations, but then the problem is that these cases with politicians, when they are in court, and most of them in the high court, like Supreme Court, they are there for 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, and nothing happens. The judges just postpone them without having reached the decisions on the merits. And once again, they say, this is my independence. If I postpone a case for 3, 4, 5 years, no one should ask me why I do this. And that's what they do in these political cases. There will be a report from the commission now in July, and I know they had an interview. They interviewed they had peer review missions, and they looked at this, because that's a problem. If you don't have decisions, court decisions, what's the effectiveness of all this? And apparently some judges said basically that they are not going to be those who will convict these politicians. So many other things to say, but I'll stop here. Thank you
very much. The second speaker will be Professor Alan Smith.
Well, I was going to talk about the economic reforms, and John did ask me to make some comparisons, perhaps, particularly with Greece, which I'm going to do, but I would like to stress that the problems facing Romania are nowhere near as severe as those facing Greece. So I don't want people to go away saying, oh, we said it's just as bad there in Romania as it is in Greece, because it certainly isn't. They're problems of degree. Well, the PDL government really is in the middle of a reform package which combines an austerity programme with structural reforms. As I said, there are similarities with Greece, largely because much of the programme is a standard IMF EU austerity plus basic reform type of package. So if I go through the similarities with Greece, I think the one is firstly how they got into the position they're in now, the macroeconomic problems facing those countries. Well, both Greece and Romania between 2004 and 2008 pursued sort of pro-cyclical macroeconomic policies in a period of boom under what were really centre-right governments, resulting in high fiscal deficits which have led to increasing public debt. They both also greatly increased public sector employment, which is part of political patronage in many cases, resulting in an overstaffed bureaucracy. In Romania, for example, public sector wages, that's personnel costs, grew by 33% between 2000 and 2009. That's the equivalent of 2% of GDP, which is quite a lot when you start working it out in what it means in fundamental taxation. In both economies as well in this period, we have private sector wage growth vastly in excess of productivity. In Romania, for example, wages grew by 23% in 2008, of course, in the run-up to elections. Also, pensions and other benefits grew faster than GDP in the 2006-08 period in the run-up to elections, and this is part of a straightforward electoral cycle where you make these promises and then the incoming government has to do something about honouring them in some case. On the outside, we can't blame governments for. Both countries experienced a rapid expansion of consumer credit to purchase consumer durables. In the Romanian case, very much funded by outside banks, by foreign banks, following what we told the Romanians to do, which was to liberalise their capital account. And this resulted in many cases in unsustainable levels of household consumption and household indebtedness. In Romania, for example, then the three combined meant that household consumption actually grew by 48% between 2005 and 2008, which is clearly unsustainable in the long run. Critically, however, this consumption spilled over to imports, and both countries experienced unsustainable current account deficits. In Romania, the current account deficit was 12.4% of GDP in 2008, exactly the same figure as it was in Greece in 2009. Then there are structural similarities between the countries which complicate recovery and are the subject of reforms and the subject of the anti-corruption reforms, political reforms and so on. Both countries have very large secondary economies in excess of 25% of recorded GDP that avoid taxation, and both countries have widespread problems concerning tax compliance and tax collection, cigarette smuggling and so on, and just straightforward tax evasion. Also, both countries have very large, predominantly self-sufficient agrarian economies that legally avoid taxation. If you're producing for yourself, then in most cases you don't pay taxation on it. If there are small local markets, then VAT tends not to get paid, and so on and so on. So the agrarian sectors in both countries are net recipients of state finance because people still get benefits. They still get pensions and so on, but they don't contribute so much to the tax bill. Well, as a result, tax receipts in Romania, for example, are only 28% of GDP. In Greece, they're 29% of GDP, whereas the EU average is 40%. In practice, we find that the Romanian budget revenues, total revenues, consolidated, state, local, and so on, have really never got higher than 32% of GDP, whereas the average in the EU is around 44%. Well, this then gives you severe problems of how do you fund essential expenditure on education, health, infrastructure, legitimate welfare payments, and so on. They've also both got long-term problems with their pension systems, including a declining and aging population with low birth rates now and early retirement rates. Retirement rates are averaging 55. And then a system of privileged pensions, which is rather linked to what Ms. McAvey was saying, unrelated to contributions. In Romania's case, this is principally for magistrates, parliamentarians, diplomats, and so on, who then get a pension virtually for the fact that they have served in that office, however long they did it. We shouldn't be too smug about this. We do the same with our prime ministers, MPs, and so on. But again, it's another major example of political patronage. And again, there are other areas, a powerful super-rich elite, high-level and low-level of corruption, and more crucially, perhaps, also, high rates of unemployment among young people, over 25% for people under 25. What are the differences between Romania and Greece? Well, the first one, of course, is Romania is not in the Eurozone, although it hopes to join in 2015, or this raises a major question of why. And its currency isn't pegged to the euro, giving it some freedom to devalue, although this is constrained by the amount of debt that's denominated in euros, particularly household debt. Romania has also been subject to detailed scrutiny by missions from the IMF and the EU, and these haven't, in fairness to Romania, must be said, haven't detected major problems with statistics or financial information that there has been in the case of Greece. There are technical problems and so on, but not, they argue, downright falsification. The third difference, the one I really touched, is that debt ratios for Romania and Greece are vastly different. Critically, public debt in Romania is growing rapidly. It grew from 18.4% of GDP to 37.8% at 2006 to nearly 38% at the end of 2010. And the critical problem is that roughly two-thirds of this is being funded outside the country. It's not quite like the United Kingdom case, although the government says it's the opinion doesn't say that, where the debt is largely raised internally and then it goes into our own pension funds and so on. In this case, the debt is being raised, some cases from the IMF, but also from private finance. So when you service that debt, it is a net loss to your economy. Total foreign debt is also, but if we look at those figures, government debt is 75% of GDP. Foreign currency assets held by the National Bank are about 30% of GDP. So the net level is about 45%, compared with Greece, where it's 150%. So it's nowhere near the same problem is in terms of scale. Similarly, again, then externally debt is now about 93 billion, though a lot of this is about 75% of GDP. Sorry, I've got that was external debt is about 45% of GDP. Government debt is far lower than that. It's actually only about 25 to 30% of GDP. So there's not a major problem with either of those two magnitudes. The problem really was the speed with which they were developing, which would have become a problem if you had actually done something about it. And another major difference really is that public unrest in response to government austerity programs, at least my interpretation, you may disagree with me, has been relatively muted compared to Greece, or even the United Kingdom. You'd expected that the austerity program that's gone through in Romania, you'd have had a job doing that in the United Kingdom without having, I mean, we probably will have more strikes and so on in this country than you really have had in Romania, and maybe people want to talk about that. Well, how did these things happen, and what is the government trying to do?
They go to court in Romania.
They
go to court.
And go to court?
Yes.
And they believe the courts? Or mm-hmm.
Yes, court issued the judgment.
The constitutional, yeah.
The ordinary court issued judgment saying that the cutting of the salary was illegal, and then it returns them back, so they don't need to go to street. I'm just saying.
When it works, yeah, sometimes. Do they trust their unions as well, is the other point I was wondering, I'm not sure. Maybe I should leave that. What are they doing now and what's happened? Well, we said Romania really experienced a major boom between 2005 and the third quarter of 2008 when Lehman Brothers collapsed. This was followed really by a bust when GDP fell by 7.7% in 2009 and 1.3% last year. Modest growth is expected this year, but effectively I would argue the economy is really flatlining. Just about over the last year. The critical problem really was that the growth that we experienced between 2005 to 2008 was a bubble, as it has been in many West European economies as well. So the capital inflows, growing wages, growing credit, and so on led to a rapid expansion of consumer credit, which was then aggravated by government deficits. So the government deficit, the fiscal deficit, had reached 4.8% of GDP in 2008, which was actually at a period when you were very high, it was a structural deficit, you had very high macroeconomic activity, very high levels of taxation, abnormally high levels of taxation, because you're importing so many goods and paying VAT on them. Once you can't import those goods, then of course your VAT receipts collapse, income tax revenues start to collapse, and so on. Similarly, again, current account deficit 12.4% of GDP in 2008, and then we have Lehman Brothers. All of these deficits are effectively being funded externally. Once the credit dries up, then of course you can't fund them. So what do you do? Well, what Romania did succeed in doing was to secure a standby agreement with the IMF in March of 2009, which gave it nearly 20 billion euros of credits. But it's this that has really largely shaped economic policy in the period 2009 up to the current day. The government was required to progressively reduce fiscal deficits, or to contain fiscal deficits, by making cuts in public sector wages, cutting public sector employment, proposed to pensions, social security benefits, and increasing taxes. During 2009, I think in the first half of 2010, IMF and EU finance effectively replaced private finance and did allow the government perhaps to pursue, well, put it this way, the situation had been a lot worse without that finance, whatever you think of the IMF. And the IMF did make gave the government some wiggle room to pursue, if you like, pro-growth policies. But because the economy stagnated, of course, then VAT receipts fell, income tax receipts fell, so the pressure on the fiscal deficit started to augment. The government then, in 2010, tried to impose and further budget cuts, but we found in the beginning of the year that actually pressures for expenditure were taking the deficit into even further, larger than it would have been, possibly 9% of GDP. And the government then imposed an austerity programme in July 2001. And it proposed to do cut public sector wages by 25%. This is in addition to planned reductions in personnel. And to cut pensions by 15%, whereas, Ms. McElvey said then, protest of the Constitutional Court, this was overturned as unconstitutional. So they increased VAT by 5 percentage points from 19% to 24% instead. In practice, the measures were obviously deeply unpopular, but they did succeed in improving tax returns in the second half of last year, in the first 5 months of this year. Much of this actually has come from increased VAT receipts, which wasn't in the initial programme in the first place. But, of course, the austerity programme has kicked back, if you like, any form of recovery. So we then get another fall in the second half, or the third quarter of 2010, as, of course, the impact, particularly of these increased taxation, was felt on retail trade. And then the recovery in the third or last quarter of last year, first quarter of this year, has been relatively modest from that, partly stimulated really by the growth of exports. Well, again, it's austerity hasn't been the only thing. The government has been required to bring about reforms, and it has brought in fairly far-reaching reforms, though one doesn't know how they'll actually come in practice. I'll leave these perhaps for other people to talk about. We've seen reforms to the pension system, increasing retirement rates, and attempting to abolish privileged pensions, bringing everything onto a single spine is the argument, so that everybody will be... The problem for Romania, of course, is that nearly all pensions are public sector pensions, pay as you go, unlike this country. And another point I think should possibly be made on pensions is that they're not concentrated pro-poor. If you look at the decile rates for income, you find that people at the top rates of the income distribution are receiving a substantial proportion of income in the form of pensions. So there is a need in that sense for pension reform. Others are reforms to the public sector wages and wage formulation, proposals to tackle corruption. And more lately, we're now coming into two major reforms. Reform to the Labour Code, I don't know how this will actually operate, but which is meant to be so-called bringing flexible labour, which normally is a euphemism for making it easier to sack people, but also incorporates, in this case, greater legislation against the secondary economy. So you can now be fined quite severely, according to the legislation, for illegally employing people in the secondary economy. Whether it's working or not on the ground, I leave other people to talk about. And now we're seeing, similar to Greece again, greater measures to increase the privatisation, sales of remaining state-owned assets in what are majority private-owned enterprises, and again, what is going to be very unpopular, further moves to liquidate or privatise loss-making state-owned enterprises. And there's a sort of IMF hit list of 154 companies, and that probably will, I think that will be fairly critical when it comes into force. Well, I'll stop.
Thank you very much, Alan.
And our third speaker is Dr. Catalina Vramescu.
Well, thank you very much, John. Just one word about end of your talk. You were mentioning the labor code. The government says that it's only in the space of just a few weeks, about 200,000, if I remember well, new labor contracts have surfaced following the adoption of this new labor code, and that's quite a lot. I mean, if you compare to less than 5 million people, you know, that's the size of the labor market. If that's true, that's very significant. But I leave to others to, you know, sort of analyze the data, because my purpose now is to talk about electoral reform. In fact, I'd like to focus on the electoral system itself. I'll do three things. First, I'll give you an overview of the electoral system, or rather systems that we currently employed or used to employ in Romania. And then I'll make a few references to some countries in the area, especially in the Balkans, in the area of the Balkans. And finally, and perhaps that's most perhaps most interesting for you, I'll try to come up with a few lessons from the raw data. First, the overview of the electoral system. It was the system that we used for legislative elections was adopted basically in 1990, just months, few precious months after the downfall of the Ceausescu regime. It's a proportional closed list system. I think this is highly significant. It was adopted without much debate, and it proved to be remarkably stable in the sense that, well, it wasn't changed till 2008. So a good number of elections were actually organized according to this purely proportional closed list system. The parties were shaped for a number of electoral cycles by this law, and that was only changed in 2008 at the last general election, when a supposedly new system came into place, came to replace this one, and that new system was called, was locally called, the uninominal system. Well, it is not what we should technically call a uninominal system. In fact, it's again a purely proportional system, a rather bizarre system where you, in fact, use uninominal constituencies, single winner. You vote for the candidates, but then what is first taken into account is actually the vote for the party, because each candidate is supposed to represent a political party. And then the grand score is calculated at national level. The then you calculate the seat allocations for each party, and then you determine what who is eligible in the from these single winner constituencies. So it means that the candidate who gets most votes could lose a seat, and perhaps someone from the second or third or even fourth place could actually get a mandate, could get a seat. It's a rather bizarre system. It resembles from afar the system that's being used in Slovenia, and the system that was being used for a while in Italy for the elections for the Italian Senate. It's strange. I mean, it looks like first past the post, but in fact it's a purely proportional system. To give you another, I think, interesting element, more than 20% of the current MPs are actually candidates who failed to get most votes in their constituencies. So they are, you know, they were ranked second, third, or even fourth. Perhaps at the extreme of that specter, we have one MP who managed to get elected after gathering something like 34 votes. Now that's very little, because typically MPs are elected with something like 15,000, 20,000, even more. That one was elected due to a quirk in the electoral arithmetic. He was elected with just 34 votes. Now, these are the oddities of the current electoral system, much criticized. Question is, why was that introduced? Because it failed to address the interest of the two main parties who actually stood most to lose from that system. And the simple answer, because it was in the interest of the National Liberal Party, the third party then, in the order of the electoral weight of the Romanian political parties. They were in charge of the minority government then. They were supported by a large party, the Socialists, and that was a trade-off between the Socialists and the National Liberals. More than 50% of their MPs are in fact people who would not have been elected otherwise. If a system like FPTP, first past the post, would have been used. Now, another interesting and perhaps largely overlooked component of the electoral system there is the system, or rather the system that are used for local elections. Now, local elections are a big thing in Romania. If only for the importance of the local factors in the overall economy of politics in Romania. In other words, local organizations are quite and tend to be even stronger, quite strong, and tend to be even stronger in the last few years. From the very beginning, that is from 1992, we used proportional closed lists again for electing local councillors and provincial councillors, and we used for electing mayors in Romania. Most mayors are, all mayors are elected from the level of the village to the level of the capital city. All mayors are elected. They were elected according to the there has to be a majoritarian system. It's two rounds. We sometimes call this the French system. A few days ago, the president signed into law a bill changing this system into FPTP, first past the post. So starting next spring, mayors will be elected according to first past the post. And finally, for the European elections, European MPs are elected again using proportional closed list. Proportional closed list, this is what we have there. And of course, we have direct presidential elections, two rounds, like in most countries where you have direct presidential elections. Now, this is the general presentation. And now, before trying to extract a few the lessons from that, just let me very briefly present you a few data about elections, about electoral systems in a number of countries in the region, again, especially in the Balkans. Croatia, closed list proportional from 1995. You see? Slovenia, proportional, with uninominal constituencies, pretty much similar with, to the Romanian system. Serbia, closed party lists, one national constituency. Macedonia, now it's mixed. From 2002 it's proportional, again. Montenegro, one national constituency, proportional. Bosnia, proportional within each ethnic group. Kosovo, proportional. Greece, for good measure, I added Greece. It's the so-called reinforced proportionals, meaning that the front runners are given an electoral bonus, but otherwise it's proportional. What do we see here? Well, we see a number of things. If we look at the region, we see the dominance of proportional system. purely proportional system. There are a few, or there were a few, mixed systems, but even where you find mixed systems in Eastern Europe, typically they are dominated by their proportional component. So majoritarian electoral systems are, you know, practically nowhere to be seen there. For the I'm talking about, of course, about legislative the elections for the parliament. So we have a dominance of proportionalism, and if we have a dominance of proportionalism, then the next question perhaps is, has proportionalism lived up to its expectations? Because as you know, most of you I'm sure are already aware that there is a huge body of literature dealing with the effects of majoritarian versus proportional election rules in different contexts. And question is, has proportionalism lived up to its expectations in Eastern Europe? And of course I refer especially to Romania, but perhaps debate could also be expanded to refer to most countries in Eastern Europe. My simple answer is, by and large, no. For a number of reasons. Now, one prediction about proportionalism is that it boosts participation rates. Now, at least compared to majoritarian electoral systems. Now, and the data, as far as Romania is concerned, are very clear. Proportionalism has not been very helpful in boosting the participation rate. On the contrary, it's a constant decline. Of course, one could argue the elections 1990, of course, a few months after the downfall of the communist regime, of course, perhaps were not exactly one's typical election, but still, we see a historical decline of the rates of participation. Another thing is, stability. Well, stability versus change. Has proportionalism been conducive to to a controlled change of the political elite? By and large, no. I'll come back to this issue a little bit later, because I also want to address another prediction about party size. The party sizes. Now, that's a fairly important issue. It's a little bit more technical, so please forgive me that I'll address it, very briefly. Now, proportionalism seemed to be more conducive to the establishing of a larger number of parties that are politically significant than, purely majoritarian systems. Now, this has not exactly happened. And one of the reasons for which this has not exactly happened is that we started to use proportionalism with relatively high electoral thresholds. It used to be 3%. We raised the bar to 5%. And the number of politically significant parties in the parliament, and this is a trend that we see elsewhere in Eastern Europe, I mean it's practically everywhere, has dropped. We have now basically 4 political parties. Has proportionalism done something for the stability of the parties themselves? Well, not really. On the contrary, what we see is that the party system seems to be fairly fragmented, but not during elections, but in between the elections. There are splits in the parties, there are fusions between different parties and movements, wings, different groups of different parties. It seems sometimes that what these electoral systems did for the political system as a whole is a rather strange phenomenon. Parties have almost ceased to chase, to run after voters, and in fact they've started to negotiate among themselves. Because what we see here is that while on the one hand the number of politically significant parties has dropped, on the other hand, the possibility of one party of or of one coalition to gather a majority in the parliament has also dropped. Just to give you a few examples, this time not from Romania, again, I think they are quite significant, sorry. Okay, let me show you a few results. Say, for instance, say from Croatia, from 2007, the last legislative elections in Croatia, we have from 151 seats of the unicameral parliament there, we have the Croatian Democratic Union 36%, that is 66 seats, Social Democrat 31%, 56 seats, Green-Yellow Coalition, 5 parties, 6% together, 8 seats, and Liberal Democrat 6%, 7 seats. If one could tell me how a majority is predictable with this kind of distributions, I'd be very happy. It's not predictable for the voters. Perhaps for the party elites, yes, but not for the voters. Another example, you have Serbia, close party lists, 2008, European Serbia 38%, Radicals 29%, Democratic Party 11%, Socialists 7%, Liberal Democrats 5%, Hungarians 2%. Where's the majority here? Beats me, I don't know. So the elections, from the point of view of the capacity of the voters to anticipate the outcome, you know, highly volatile. Frankly, I'd be a voter here. I would be, frankly, very, very much at pain to predict the kind of majority that would emerge from this. And in fact, the example of Romania proves exactly this point. We have pretty much every combination that was tried and failed eventually, that was tried, every combination of parties that are politically significant, it was tried and failed after 1 or 2 years. You have Social Democrats with Democrat Liberals, you have National Liberals being supported by the Social Democrats, we have the Democrat Liberals with National Liberals, etc., etc. Now we have Democrat Liberals, Hungarians, minority, and the dissident wing of the Social Democrats. So, you know, life is complex. Now, one other thing that needs to be said is that the electoral reform was approached from a very narrow angle. In fact, what was interesting for the politicians was basically only the formula that was meant to transform votes into mandates. But other elements, and I would sometimes call them other safety features of the system, were actually not exactly considered. I'd give you a few examples. There's a huge degree of gerrymandering. These constituencies are heavily gerrymandered. In Romania, pretty much nobody seemed to care much about this thing. Or, for instance, the law dealing with the financing of the campaigns. Not much interest about that either. Another aspect, it's advanced or absentee voting. Again, we don't have these features built into our system. And what is most worrisome for me, especially due to the dominance of the closed party list, especially in local elections, it's the absence of a meaningful system of party primaries. In fact, how these lists are constituted is very simple. The party nomenclature, in fact, you know, simply nominates the candidates. Pretty much that simple. The political effects of this practice are very easy to foresee. Now, One final observation. Romania seemed to be going against the grain when we talk about electoral reform. Now, most countries in Eastern Europe, in fact, almost all countries now employ a proportional system. Some of these countries used to employ a mixed system or even a majoritarian system for a brief period. Now it seems that there is some sort of consensus about the use of proportionalism. However, Romania might be that one country that jumps back into the camp of a majoritarian system. There is talk now about reintroducing FPTP for parliamentary elections. There was even a talk about FPTP for electing the president, but it's still a minority view. So that would be, in the larger context of electoral studies, that would be, an oddity, frankly. And the reasons for that perhaps are in themselves quite interesting and are worth our attention. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much to our three speakers. We have 20-25 minutes for questions from the floor. I'd ask you to first identify yourself and any affiliation, and then place your questions to our panelists. Why don't I take groups of three, and so we'll have one, two, three.
Hi, I'm Octavian Antoni. I'm a graduate student at the University of Oxford, and I'm also the secretary of the European Monetary Society there. Romania and Bulgaria joined together in the European Union in 2007. I would just like to comment about a series of events that happened in two countries in the last 2 weeks. So, first of all, Bulgaria recalled 30 ambassadors that collaborated with the former communist regime. And in Romania, the vice president of the Senate, speaking about Mr. Dan Popescu, was found guilty of having been an informer of the Securitate, the political police in communist Romania. And he hasn't resigned, and he will not resign, and he will stay on his job. Second, Bulgaria passed a law that would allow the state to confiscate assets that cannot be justified. And in Romania, there's an article in the constitution saying that the licit character of the assets is presumed. And I know that President Băsescu is trying right now to modify the constitution, and he made a proposal to remove that article from the constitution, but it was declared unconstitutional by the Romanian Constitutional Court, saying it would make a lot of people feel insecure about their assets. And this decision was criticized today by the US ambassador to Romania, saying that Americans simply won't invest in a country where that can be seen as corrupt. So my question, particularly for Mrs. McElvey, is why is there a lack of will in Romania to implement reforms? Thank you very much, and maybe we look forward to seeing you in Oxford next year.
Mr. Ambassador.
I'm the ambassador of Romania. I would comment on the electoral reform so brilliantly presented by Caterina Bromescu, because I believe this is for either for politicians, for professors, or for students, not for diplomats, to comment on that. But I will make a comment, if you allow me, Professor Nick, on your remarks, and I'll have a question for you. So, on your remarks, listening to what you have said, I was tempted to move my fortune, which I don't have it, from Romania to Greece, because I would be better off there, which I believe is not the case. I would rather compare what is happening in Romania from an economic point of view now with what is happening in Britain, because both governments took tough but necessary measures to assure the sound economy and the recovery. I know, and this was also in a way a conclusion of the meeting President Băsescu had 2 weeks ago with Prime Minister Cameron here, and I know you have attended the conference our President had here to the LSE, and it touched upon these topics on I have met yesterday morning in a breakfast Business Secretary Vince Cable, and he was also convinced that the recovery is still fragile, but we are on the good track. And okay, having 40% public debt is not so much. Look at countries like USA, okay, a much bigger economy, or Britain. We are not in the same situation as Greece, as Spain, as Ireland, or Portugal. This is for sure. And the University of Leeds has released, I think, the end of last year, a study showing that Romania, together with Turkey, are the most attractive business destination in Central and Eastern Europe, plus Middle East, plus Africa. I wouldn't continue too much. The idea is that I would like to see something on positive, because in a way we deserve some encouragement for what we have done. And this government was so courageous in Romania during the last 1.5 years. And question for Monica Marcovei, because you have mentioned what is really problematic in the judicial reform in Romania, and I have to say I share your view on many aspects. But you didn't mention, or I didn't notice, the achievements, the positive achievements for your peers term as a minister, and there were many important achievements that have been continued by Cătălin Predoiu after you, and we fight a lot not to remove the cooperation verification mechanism tonight here in this seminar, but to show that we did a lot of progress. And I would like to see from you, as a former minister and having such a huge experience in the field and fighting so much for this reform, the full half of the glass, not only the empty one.
And a third question?
My name is Maria Nago. I'm a postgraduate student here at the LSE in Urban Planning Studies. I have a question for Mrs. Marcovei concerning the current administrative reform, territorial administrative reform. Going beyond the doubtful economic rationale of having the next 8 counties later on, I would like to hear your opinion on the impact of this reform on the risks of corruption in local administration. Do you think maybe we should fear any trends to of power accumulation, or maybe increased power of local so-called barons stemming from these administrative reforms? Or do you think this might have a positive impact on the risks of corruption?
The first question referred to what Bulgaria did, and I congratulate Bulgaria for what they did. We were in a package before the accession, each country took the lead for different periods of time, but I don't want to refer to this. They did very good, and with the confiscation, with cleaning the diplomacy, and also with the attitude they have, public and political, on the cooperation and verification mechanism. In my view, and I'm happy that the ambassador is here, I'm saying this to all ambassadors where I find them, Romania has a wrong position, and as we see, it's a failure, and I will explain why. And I believe that I'm ambassador of Romania when I say this. So I'll come to this, to the verification cooperation mechanism, and then very concretely on the confiscation. So when Romania and Bulgaria joined at the end of 2006, we imagined, we built this together with the Commission cooperation and verification mechanism, which means that the European Commission looks into these countries, still has a leg in these countries, issues an annual report, and looks at the problematic issues, the promises we made, And I tell you, I contributed, I asked for this mechanism, the commission. When I saw what was happening in 2006 and I couldn't promote any anti-corruption measure, yes, I asked for this mechanism because I think, I believe I serve the people and the people want to have these changes done. Actually, I remember that the Bulgarian officials were very angry with me because we were in a package and Romania couldn't have a mechanism without Bulgaria having a mechanism. So, and everyone was saying, we want to join as the other countries in 2004, clean, without anything. Fine. But if I see that the political will is going down, if you remember, I couldn't adopt the agency, National Agency of Integrity, this is what I thought I did well for the country, and I still believe, and I think it was very useful, this mechanism. As I said, otherwise the anti-corruption prosecutors wouldn't be there any longer. Now, the Bulgarian attitude with this last government related to Schengen and this, let's say, I'll call it mechanism, is this one. Thank you very much for the mechanism to the European Commission. Thank you very much for the mechanism. It really helps us at home because we want to make these changes. It helps those who want to produce these changes because they have the same problems, yes? There are benchmarks in the mechanism. So you want anti-corruption, you want reform of the judiciary, you have them in the mechanism. There are judges or other political forces or other institutions which are opposed to these reforms. You say we have this mechanism and we have to do it for the EU, exactly like before the accession. Now, Romania didn't have this position. Romania says, you said, we fight a lot to remove the CVM. And that's what I saw in the public foreign policy.
It's a process.
And I fight to keep it until the moment we accomplish all these benchmarks. So Romania said, it's not connected to Schengen. We need to get rid of it. That was basically the policy. And really, to me, it was a failure. And now if we look at the Schengen decision and we see that what Germany and Netherlands say, we want to see the next report on the mechanism, which means we deny for 1 year the relation between Schengen and the mechanism. And then after 1 year, where we are? It's even more important, the mechanism, than it was 1 year ago, if we relax and say, okay, yes, we want to do this. So the attitude is, we have these problems, this is what I did, these are the obstacles, help me here and there. And I think that's a normal attitude. And I think this is, again, this is the good foreign policy which we should have in relation to the mechanism or to the corruption, because I also had heard colleagues from the same party with me, members in the European Parliament, doing lobby for Schengen and how they did lobby for Schengen. They're going to other MPs saying, how can you tell me how many kilos of corruption we have in Romania, 15 or 18? And that person was, so the answer is, well, if you can't tell me if it's 15 or 18, it means you cannot measure it. And if you cannot measure it, don't mention that there is a corruption problem. Or other statements. There are other corrupt countries in the Schengen area, like Greece, like Italy. Now, to me, this is a wrong policy. If in this house we have three problems, why do we need two more? I first need to solve the problem. I don't need to get two more countries with the same problem. So, again, that's my advice, and that's what Bulgaria did. As I started from Bulgaria. Thank you very much for the mechanism. It helps us to continue at home these reforms.
You're certainly right. Sorry, but my question was related to the progress we have made since.
So we made. It's just
we
that
have been, you have
we
been
made. I eliminated all the red flags. And yes, but we still have problems. And I think it's more important to have these annual reports to say to the judges from the Supreme Court that they didn't. Or to push the Supreme Council of Magistracy to change. Otherwise, or also the politicians. Yes. So, on confiscation, very shortly for everyone. There is a unique provision in the Romanian constitution instituting an assumption that all the assets are legally, an assumption, a legal, a constitutional assumption, that all the assets are legally gained. Now, and it's unique, the only country which has it is Republic of Moldova, which copied to a large extent the Romanian constitution. So you don't have this provision in countries with traditions in respecting property rights, like UK, like United States, and like all the other countries, democratic countries. What's the difference? And I will also give you an example from Serious Organized Crime Agency here in UK, SOCA. So now, if I have a person who is investigated for organized crime or for a corruption, I have the custom officers investigated. But I catch him, of course I catch him always in the criminal case in something, in one act, with a 10,000 euro bribery, let's say. Then I will only be able to confiscate 10,000 euro of the bribery, or 200 euros if I catch with 200 euros, yes, once. But if I look at all the assets and then his salary, for instance, I see that it's a huge disproportion and I cannot confiscate. Now that's called extended confiscation and exists in all the European Union. It's also a framework decision saying that you can confiscate as a judge the property of a person for which you convict only for a fact of corruption or organized crime, because you never can convict in criminal cases for everything. So this will not be possible because it was rejected, this change by the Constitutional Court. Very strange. The Constitutional Court said that this would affect the right to property, which again it exists in all these countries. And I'll give you an example. Moreover, here in UK, there is SOCA, the Serious Organized Crime Agency, which if they can't make evidence for a criminal trial, then they initiate a civil, this agency, a civil trial where the evidence is a proportional principle 50-50%, so less than in a criminal case, and they can confiscate. They can ask me, how did you make all these assets you have, looking at your income, without convicting me for a criminal case. So this is civil confiscation. This again would not be, it will not be again possible in Romania. Yes, there are good things done, and just that's how I am. I think if we talk about lessons learned, I'm going to, you know, to say what are the problems. I'd like to say one more thing, because you mentioned the pensions, and I think that's important. The special pensions, it's probably the same in all the sectors. So for judges and prosecutors, in 2005 and the years before, the pension was like this calculated in the law, 80% of the income in the last month. So nothing to do with the contributions, in the last month, and not salary, income. If they were also teaching somewhere, or okay, it was everything. And then I changed the law, very difficult. At least I set the first step to make it 80% of the last year. I left in 2007, and within 2 months the law was back, and it's back now, 80% of the last month. That's nothing to do with the contribution and and to have a healthy pension system. And also the judges in Romania increase their own salaries by their own judgments. That's very difficult to explain. And the last thing, and in the courts they are basically, for all this legal cutting of the salaries by law, the judges are returning the difference, invoking the European Convention of Human Rights, which is false. There is now decision of the European Court of Human Rights saying that the cut of a salary or of a pension is a violation of the right to property. But one politician said that on TV, and it went like this, and judges, just by hearing, they argue and they put it in writing, and we have these decisions.
I'm sorry if I came over so negative. I must have been one of those economists accused of predicting nine out of the last three global recessions. But I tried to stress that the problems are nowhere near as severe as Greece. The debt ratios are nowhere near as bad as Greece. And the problem was the rate of progress of the debt. And therefore, the success was that this had been nipped in the bud to some extent. And without yet, I say, the degree of difficulty, protests that you'd see probably in the United Kingdom. We might debate what our views are on the United Kingdom's economy. I'm not sure that I was going to make comparisons with the UK economy. I certainly think in the period 2005 to 2008, the two major factors were, firstly, the role of foreign banks in expanding credit, particularly in the retail sector to households. I sympathise to some extent with the government for that, because the EU and we encouraged Romania to liberalise its capital account. I'm an economist who doesn't think liberalising your capital account is always a very good idea, particularly under those circumstances. But the other was really a very rash macroeconomic policy by the Terry Chalmers government, which everybody was telling them not to do, including their own national bank. I mean, Izărescu was saying you cannot run deficits at this level. So
he is unrepentant. To this day, he is unrepentant, the former prime minister. Unrepentant. Progress through consumption. That's his mantra.
It is in some ways. Same with Bush and Reagan to some extent as well. Yet radical right politicians who don't bother about taxation but still spend. It doesn't always work. But I mean, I think that has been to the credit of the current government, that it has cut this back. And in practice, actually, on our predictions last year for the Economist Intelligence Unit, we were the more optimistic, and unfortunately we were the ones who were most wrong, because we thought the fall in output wouldn't be as severe as quite a lot of other people were predicting. So actually, if anything, we've been on that case more on the optimistic side of predictions.
If you will indulge us, we'll extend the session somewhat, because I know there are a lot more questions, so we'll take another round. We'll have one, two, let's do four this time, three, four.
Probably, arguably, be a much more severe misdemeanor than the ambassadors as such. And I personally find it rather ridiculous that 21, 22 years after transitions, we're still talking about lustration and so on and so forth, whereas in Bulgaria there's never been a proper law to that extent. So I think the comparison is just wrong. I mean, if you're looking for a practice that would be better suited to Romania, you really should not be looking to Bulgaria for that. In that particular instance. The same goes for confiscation of assets. That is a law that lends itself in the constitutional court for the fact that the legal period over which one is supposed to keep all sorts of documentation to prove their wealth is 10 years, has always been 10 years. But this law is now not limited to any particular period of time, so you could be asked how you gained your assets in 1990 and you wouldn't have the documents to prove it. Plus, each one of us, including myself as a Bulgarian, have received a questionnaire to answer how their income was accumulated each year. But that isn't subject to any particular law, and therefore I have no guarantee that the information being collected on me, incidentally by the Ministry of Interior, isn't landing itself into the wrong hands. So I think, again, if you're looking for a method or a mechanism to combat corruption, that probably isn't the right one. And my quick question is on unions. I was very intrigued by the sort of what you discussed actually there are no protests in Romania, there are no protests in Bulgaria either. But you know, in Bulgaria, union leaders are on the government payroll, and I was just wondering whether that is also the case in Romania, and therefore explain why unions are so inefficient in organizing some sort of civil society.
In EU with this cultural languages. My question is to Mr. Catalina Hamas, what do you make out of the Hungarian's threat to leave the government?
Hungarian's threat to leave the government.
Okay, Dan Brett from CIS. Question is, Matt, given how entrenched corruption is in networks and how there's so many political appointees across the board, is there any hope for reform anytime soon? Question for Alan, is it going to get worse before it gets better, or is it just going to get worse? And question for Dr. Abramescu, surely it's not just all about electoral systems, you've actually got to look at the types of parties that are developing, and the really key factor is the way in which closed party lists have skewed party development by completely divorcing party members from any sense of agency over party organisational structure.
Another two points from Kingston University. My question to Katarina Baromeski links to the previous one. It's about electoral systems. You asked the question whether PR lived up to its expectations, and your answer was no, roughly. I presume that refers to sort of Eastern Europe rather than the whole of Europe to begin with, because it works pretty well in, dare I say, Scandinavian countries. But is it down to the electoral system itself? Is there anything wrong about the electoral system, or about the conditions, the specific conditions in which the system operates? And I'm referring to things such as the fact that there are no real cleavages, there's massive cross-migration and clientelism that goes, you know, between and across parties, and that makes it less relevant, the operational qualities of the electoral system itself. And a question for this, it's about the labour reform and the secondary economy. I'm wondering whether there's any way, and I'm wildly speculating here, to deal with, I don't know how I should call it, the semi-second economy. And I'm talking about employees that work on the minimum salary and are paid more than minimum salary on ad hoc arrangements between employers. And I presumably speculate that's the case where the vast majority of people working in Romania on minimum wage. They work on minimum wage on paper, whereas they are paid more cash in hand on top of that. And that's very difficult to control, but it also contributes to the low percentage in tax receipt.
Thanks.
What do I make of the about the threat of the National Union of Hungarians leaving the government? I don't know. It's to be seen. My feeling is that generally the Romanian political parties are not in the mood, perhaps with a few exceptions, to precipitate elections towards the end of the year. So, no, I'd be a little bit skeptical, but, you know, I'm no prophet, who knows. Now, as to the public protest, so you said that in Bulgaria the union leaders are on government payroll. I don't know about Romania, but the fact of the matter is that the percentage of the people registered in unions is actually fairly small. One additional factor that complicates the landscape is that, unlike in many other countries where on the background of the economic crisis the unemployment has gone up quite significantly, take Spain. In Romania, after a short surge upwards, it actually declined. In the last year, it declined considerably. Now, depending on what figures you're looking at, today it's around to 5.7%. I mean, only three countries in the European Union have less unemployment, and they are Luxembourg, Holland, and I think Austria. So, It's not your typical economical crisis.
The problem is that the number of employees is also falling, so we don't know where all these people are.
Yeah.
So and there's been changes in the benefit rules. So it's people who who are not eligible for benefits is the number who's falling. So is it just that they're saying I'm not eligible for benefits, why should I go and register?
But
and go to the secondary economy.
Yeah, but that's the leaders of the trade unions announced during the fall that there will be a million men march towards the parliament, whatever. And in fact, during the same day, there was a concert of AC/DC in town, and there were three times more people going to watch AC/DC than those who, you know, chose to vent their anger against the government. So that says a lot.
They've been a form of venting anger.
Yeah, well, maybe. Well, they seem to be very content, actually, the people from the AC/DC. So, as to the closed list, there were two questions about the closed list. One major effect of closed lists is, you know, divorcing the party elites from the, you know, average supporters and voters of that party, and I fully agree with that. And I think indeed that the key term here, the key element, is that of the quality of the electoral system. That's exactly what you mentioned. Now, though I do think that in itself the closed list proportional system is has some major issues, to put it mildly. In fact, full disclosure, I do think that if the Prince of Darkness were to design an electoral system that's being geared towards ruining a country, that would be the closed list proportional system. But aside from that, I do think that you're right. I mean, it matters how the system operates, what's the context in which it is operating. And one major flaw of electoral systems there is indeed the lack of a meaningful system for nominating candidates and selecting leaders. In other words, to translate, party primaries of one way or another. We don't have that. In fact, there was a few years ago an attempt to institute some party primaries in the Social Democratic Party, and when it turned out that the candidates being selected were not exactly those whom the elite of the party would have expected, then they said, well, it's just, you know, like an opinion poll. I mean, we don't really need these elections, and they simply canceled the results. So yes, I mean, whatever system you use, be it proportional, be it even closed list, you have to pair that, to mate that with other meaningful elements like party primaries, because if you don't have that, like for instance in the German system, if you don't have that, then the whole system, no matter whether it's majoritarian, proportional, I mean, it's not going to work. Well, however, my final point is the proportional system, especially the closed list system, has a major flaw, and that is the difficulty to aggregate a stable majority. Now, that was something that plagued most governments, not only in Romania, but also in other countries. Remember that recently the government in Greece survived a very narrow vote. And then you ask questions about the energy of these governments to implement reforms. Now, most governments, in fact, in Romania, if you look year by year, most of them were actually minority governments. They were hanging from a thread. They were at the mercy of shifting majorities in the legislative. And one reason for which there were shifting majorities in the legislative is the impact of the proportional voting system. So in this respect, I think there is an internal flaw of the system that needs to be addressed somehow.
Will it get better before it gets, or worse before it gets better? I think the honest answer to that is no one knows. And there are so many unknowns in the situation. And the recovery is very, very fragile at the best, as it is in this economy in the United Kingdom. And there are political unknowns. For Romania, there are external unknowns, as there are again in the UK. I mean, Vince Cable was saying this, people haven't really worked out that we are actually price takers. You know, nobody knows what the future, really knows what the future trend is going to be of oil prices and food prices, what the impact that's going to be on living standards. We don't know what's going to happen in Greece. I don't think Romania is going to be quite so badly directly affected by Greece. But everybody's going to be affected if there's a disorderly default or something of that kind. And there are so many unknowns that are going to, over the next 6 months, that I don't think you can really predict with any degree of... you can just say that if you assume all those things away, then there might be growth of 1% or something of that kind. But apart from that, economists probably shouldn't make forecasts of that.
Do you support the economist's view that the ECB should agree to restructure Greece's debt as a best solution, or do you support the view that ECB should start restructuring Greece's debt instead of applying more austerity measures that would just enrage the people? And it's also the view of
yes, but I don't know how you do. I think the majority view is that most people think that Greece is going to have to default, that there's going to be no way out of this situation without a default. But how you do that, I don't know. And the dangers of a disorderly default, and you try to think them through, are enormous for Greece, and Greek population. If you could have some sort of orderly default.
Is there a precedent for that?
Well, not within a currency zone. This is the problem. This is the problem. I mean, you try to think of how it will, getting off the subject, but try to think how it will work. Do you suddenly close all the banks down, convert all euro-denominated debts into drachma, and then let the drachma float or something like that?
I read an article, yesterday about this proposal, and it was said that in such a eventuality
would be disastrous.
Yeah, the British exposure in Greece will rise from £1 billion to £200 billion.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing would be disastrous. The other thing is, will banks, I mean, same problem as you've got in Romania, you've got debts denominated in euro. Now, if I'm a bank and I've lent it to somebody in Greece and they want to say, well, we're redenominating this into drachma and so on, I think I might say, well, sorry, mate, I lent it to you in euro. I want it paid back in euro, not in drachma, something that's worth half the old value. The difficulties are going to be enormous. But yes, I do think, possibly reversing myself on the Charichanu argument, that yes, you're not going to get anywhere in Greece if you don't have some possibility of some economic growth. And just heaping austerity on austerity is not going to work.
We are short on time, so I think I'm going to have to give the last word to Ms. McElvey.
To take it from what you discussed about the crisis, I'd like to say that it's my strong belief that also corruption contributed to the crisis. And just to tell you that at the beginning of this month, on June 6th, the European Commission visited home. Issued a communication and the directive on to look at the anti-corruption at the level of the Union in the first time, because before now it was only a requirement for candidate countries. Once you are in, it's nothing, it's being left to the member state. And I think it's not only Romania, it's Greece, it's Spain, it's many countries. Now we discuss about the policy at the level of the Union, and in this report it's an estimation of the cost of corruption at the European Union level, €120 billion per year in European Union. That's the cost of corruption.
Is it yearly EU budget? Almost.
Sorry?
€120 billion or million?
Billion.
Billion. Is the European Union budget on a yearly basis?
No, it's in the European Union. It could be from Greek budget, or it could be from national budget.
But it's huge.
It's huge. That's what I'm saying, that corruption costs. Because if I give you a contract and I take a bribe, why do you do this? You have higher prices for the highway, for the products, for the services, and so on. So I pay more from the public money, either it's national budget or EU budget. Now in terms of hopes, yes, there are hopes, and that's what I am doing, and by all these stories, it's very difficult to fight political corruption. You have to take all the risk and to have the strategy. And for instance, we have this anti-corruption prosecutor office and other law enforcement, which were very well trained and really independent, and they had a lot of these cases, including in the last half a year, hundreds of custom officers and border police investigated and then arrested for corruption. This also showing that they act independently, because if you look at the political scene, maybe it wasn't good for Schengen, you know, to come with this case, because you go, you see, you have corruption. So that's a sign that they do their job. And also, I think my point is also with this mechanism, that it's important to support those institutions and those people that exist who are really effective in the fight against corruption. And I'm for lustration whenever it comes, and I think we suffered very much, and we still suffer if it's not there. So I welcome it. I know, we had the same discussion in Romania. But we don't have time. I say that, yeah, I welcome it. And confiscation, also, we must have this confiscation with all the legal guarantees in place, of course. But what it happens in those two countries when you are only basically confiscated if I get 100 euros as a bribe, because that's what you catch me, that's all they get from me, even if I have 1 million euros and no job.
It's always a good sign when there are too many questions, but we'll have to continue them over a glass of wine. Before we conclude, though, there's a couple of people I'd like to thank, specifically the Romanian Cultural Institute, who have been our partners in organising the event this evening, and indeed our partners in the Ghitu Ionescu series. And they have kindly provided some delicious Romanian wines for us for the reception. Particular thanks to Magda Stroi and Dorian Brania from the Institute. From Lisi, thanks to Ivan Kovanovic, who has been instrumental to organising this event. To the audience for coming along and having some great questions. And finally, to our excellent panellists for what was a fascinating and very diverse discussion. Thank you very much. Please join us for some wine. Thank you.